Hey friends, mark your calendars. The Intentional Motherhood Retreat is coming up October 23rd through 25th in Portland, Oregon. It's a meaningful few days to slow down, connect, and refocus on what matters most in your motherhood journey. Also, some exciting news, Intentional Fatherhood has officially launched on all podcast platforms, including YouTube. So go subscribe, check out the first few episodes, and share it with all the fathers in your life. For more details and registration info for the Motherhood Retreat, you can go to intentionalparents.org, or you can go check out our new website for fathers, intentionalfatherhood.org. You're listening to the Intentional Parents Podcast, brought to you by Intentional. Intentional is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope and practical help. Enjoy this week's conversation. All right, today on the show, we have Josh White. Josh is a pastor, he's a church planter, he's an author, he is a speaker, and he's also a musician. He's an all-around incredible human. We just recently sat down and had a wonderful conversation about what it looks like to really follow Jesus and share Jesus in our time. What does that mean in the regards of your own process and formation to Jesus and sanctification? It's a really deep and also helpful conversation. So I do hope you listen to through the end. If you haven't had a chance to rate and subscribe to the podcast, will you just take a moment and do that? If you're on Apple or Spotify, even on YouTube, leave a comment, even just rate the podcast. It's super helpful for us. We compete with an algorithm. We have no choice in the matter. So it's a huge gift to us when you do that. So thank you for everyone that has. And please, if you haven't had a chance, do that. But today, enjoy our conversation. Josh recently wrote a book called Stumbling Towards Eternity. We'll have that link in the show notes. But I know that you will not only laugh, but definitely potentially cry in this episode. So enjoy our conversation today with the one and the only, Josh White.
I love playing bass. It's like my favorite thing in the world. I never played bass before. I'm like, if I could sing and play at the same time, I would completely switch instruments.
Can you?
It's really hard to sing and play bass at the same time. It's kind of like playing from, it's like similar concept as playing drums, like where you just, you know, you're trying to maintain a kick pattern while doing a fast hi-hat. Like bass is weird because it's so rhythmic. Like like it's like being able to play lead while you sing. Like I'm just not that good.
Sound tired.
I know my limitations.
Sound tired.
I think you're doing a great job. We've made a decision to not tell Josh what we're talking about.
I don't even know what we're talking about.
This is great. This is the start of the podcast. This is the start of the podcast right now.
So, okay.
A distinguished guest today. And I say distinguished because age, stage, life, singer, songwriter, author. You were just playing, hopefully, you know, we should leave maybe even some of that in the clip, but writing a country album right now. Can't wait. Those were really good. I mean,
thank you.
And I mean, you always, if you know Josh, you know that he's going to show you a song and tell you one of your favorite books that you're reading in the moment or the time. What is your favorite book right now, or what are you reading?
Finished it actually is so profound and beautiful. It's this book by this Norwegian author that won the Nobel Prize last year, John Fosse.
Okay.
And it's called Septology. It actually comes in three volumes. The other name, I is the name, and then the new name are the three books. And it's a 900-page book that's one sentence. It's actually one sentence, and that sounds crazy and kind of tedious, but it's not. It's weirdly, even if you watch like the Nobel Prize speech that he gives, he converted to Catholicism not that long ago. Mm. And so I'm always interested when someone actually breaks into the literary world that actually has faith.
Yeah.
And he's at the end of his life, and the story is like a painter in Norway whose wife has died, and he's a Catholic, and it's just like you're in his mind, and he lives on the sea, and he's just reflecting on his childhood, how he met his wife, his faith, and there's reflections on, and there's a quietness to the book. The way I describe it is it's both earthy and mystic, and humble. Like, so anytime they say he's the master of saying things that can't be said. But when he does, you know, like usually when someone does kind of a theological reflection in a literary book, it comes across as, it can often come across as like they're being kind of dogmatic about what they think. like they're trying to tell you something.
Yes, yep.
He, because you're in a kind of a stream of consciousness of this old man, like anytime he reflects on God, even when it's something that I would say as a pastor is like, yeah, I don't think that's sure. right. He, sure. He always undermines himself in a very honest way where he's like, I think, but what do I know? I don't even know if one can even speak to this. Like, so he never forces anything on you. He's just giving you his thoughts and letting them come to you as they come to him.
Yes.
And so very beautiful. At first I thought it was kind of boring and then I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And then I was in the ER recently because I thought I had kidney stones, but I didn't. I just was sick. And and I read the entire second volume in one sitting.
Are you sick?
Oh, gosh.
Well, as I said, and as you heard in the intro, so one of the things I love about you, you have so many different passions, so many different skills. I've known you for a long time. We've known you since before we were – actually, the first time I met you was before we were married, but – I think we actually started working together the week after we got back from our honeymoon.
Yeah, it was the same. Definitely within a month.
Yeah, it was like something like that. We had just gotten married. So much history. I remember when your kids were, I think Henry was, the first time I met you, he was like a newborn. He's 22 now, or how's?
Henry's 22 and Hattie is 18.
Yeah. So you're.
We're on the verge of being empty nesters.
Yes.
Hattie goes to school September 16th.
How are you? And so Darcy, your wife, you guys have been married how long now?
27 years and, we've been together for 28. Yeah.
Wow.
We're going to ask you about the story of how you met. I think you shared this recently and just a great reminder of faith and evangelism and all that stuff. But you guys have been married for that long. You lead as we already mentioned, you lead a church called Door of Hope in the Portland area. And I mean, so many different things you're passionate about. Recently, last year, you were on the podcast and we were talking about your book that was out and went way deep into that, Stumbling Towards Eternity. We'll have that link in the show notes, but you're even writing some new stuff, which I'm not even sure if you, can you talk about the new stuff
sure.
So you're in the middle of writing some new stuff as well.
Yeah.
Maybe give us a little tease about that before we go into some story.
Yeah. I'm writing a small, the goal is that, thinking like, pursuit of God length, like a 90 page kind of manifesto, if you will, around what has been kind of the anchor for me as a follower of Jesus and as a pastor in a city like Portland, where the pressures from culture and even pressures from good other, Christians within the community and friends and pastor other churches, this book has really been the thing that the heart of it has been the thing that's kept me from allowing my tendency toward dabbling in everything. For a guy that is interested in everything,
yes.
When it comes to my faith, I am strangely obsessed with the centrality of the cross, and so The book is, I think right now, the working title is just called The Need for a Center. And it's really I had the first line of the book come to me this week. And
really?
It's just in the introduction. It's just, the church is the best evangelist when it understands its why.
Oh.
Yeah.
So this is truth be told. I did not tell you what we were going to talk about. And what I want to talk about is evangelism and mixture, two of your favorite words. Mm-hmm. And I think evangelism, because that word needs to be rebirthed, resold. It needs to be explained in a deeper, better way for our current moment because there's so much there. But that's really interesting that that's how you're starting. And so that was the opening.
The opening line. You know, the thought process. So the book is just focuses in on four words from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, we preach Christ crucified. And I actually gave this message the first time at The Way.
Yes.
In 2008, I think. And it was the one message John Mark's like, I was still really green as a preacher and excitable. Lots of good ideas,
dude,
but not necessarily focused.
I remember you stood there and held your Bible and didn't move.
Yeah.
Content was so rich, but you were like a stone wall.
Yeah, I was like, I did not learn how to be myself until I started Door of
It was
Hope.
Still beautiful though. It was still great, but all I'm saying is.
Yeah, but that message. Like, I just have never strayed from it. And I think the reason it resonated with people is because it was clear that it came from a deep conviction of mine. Like there's some mystery in this thing, that we preach Christ crucified. Like, is that really all we preach? And, you know, are you not preaching if you don't talk literally about the cross on a Sunday? So I've met, and what I realized is like, no, the we preach Christ crucified is that everything should point to the gospel, but should be anchored in an understanding of the gospel of grace. And so, you know, I would say like radical grace is the inevitable outcome of a right understanding of the cross, because it's the great leveler of like human existence. It's the thing that keeps a minister humble. And it's also a very easy thing to drift from. I think that our tendency is sin, you know, it's like gravity. It just has this way of pulling us away from that center. And the cross is actually the counterbalance to it that keeps us from losing our equilibrium. So that we preach Christ crucified, I just have meditated on that. You know, I do a lot of speaking for the Palau Association. And anytime I speak to pastors, and every time I've given this message, it just seems, it's like, it's funny. It's like, I think I'm some like genius or something, but there's something that just resonates with people where they act like they've never heard that before. And I always think that the truth, when it's told from a place of real honesty, does always feel fresh, you know? And I think that it's the simplicity of the gospel message, that it's so simple that we just lose it. And then it's exciting when we hear it repackaged in a way that's like, that reminds us like, oh yeah
that it's really makes good. Sense.
But I just focus in on those four words, Paul's interesting use of the word we instead of I, that the church's primary purpose is to be a sign, that we are to point the world. I reject those that say the Great Commission is not the only thing. I think that the Great Commission is the central purpose of the church, that we are to be a witness.
Yeah. Yeah.
That witness is actually the central thing.
We want to let you know about a new offering, a 31-day prayer devotional entitled Sowing a Hidden Seed, Daily Prayers for Your Child's Spiritual Growth. This book was born out of desperation. I didn't know how to lead my kids spiritually, so I started praying honest, dependent, daily prayers. Jeremiah 29:12 says, "Then you will call on me, God says, and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you." If you want to learn more, head to intentionalparents.org. And if you partner with us at $25 a month or more, we'd love to send you a copy as a thank you. Well, what I love about, I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to slow you down, because I know where you're going, and it's actually exactly where I like literally, it's so funny, where I wanted to go. But I wanted to start with the story. The cool thing is you're here with us in town. You spoke at our church, which was great. But I remember I heard this story before, but I was like, oh, it's such a good story. You opened with the story of you and Darcy, the night you met Darcy.
Yeah.
Specifically. And I think your history and how you met Jesus is a really important part of how you now even, I think, in a great, normal, but honest way, preach Jesus, explain Jesus, help people really see like, oh man, what this is about. I also want to say, and I think this is hyper important, that you specifically are really connected and honest about and raw about where not only you're at, but like you're honest about the fact that walking with Jesus is not only beautiful, it's complex, there's mixture, right? And we'll talk about that word. And lastly, when it comes to intentional, we're all about spiritual formation in the family, right? Mm-hmm. And so this, what we want to talk about today, isn't geared towards parenting. It isn't geared towards marriage. It's geared towards you as a person in many ways. And the reason I want to say that is because I think so many families actually have this beautiful responsibility to actually preach Jesus, preach Christ crucified, but we don't really understand why. We don't know what it looks like right now. We don't even really, I mean, as a culture, we're all asking the same question. Why do we even go to church?
Yeah.
So as a pastor in a progressive city, in a post-Christian environment, I would just be curious, start with your story with Darcy, but then take us through some of that, right?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. and I'd say that I actually think like these four words don't just apply to the church, but they apply to any community, which includes the community of family.
Yeah.
And a lot of it does come out of my story, which is I think coming to faith late in life made me quickly realize that the Christian life was not something that was meant to be lived alone. Mm-hmm. It's never been about just me and Jesus.
No.
And in fact, the closer I get to Jesus, the more it's become about others. And I think you can't come into the light of who Christ is without self beginning to take a back seat.
Hey, Brooke here with Intentional. Just wanted to pause really quick and say thank you to all of our legacy builders and invite you to potentially become one today. If you didn't know, Intentional is a crowdfunded nonprofit, which is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope, practical help, and healing to families all around the world, in marriage, in parenting, in grandparenting, in all sorts of relationships. We can only do that with you, our partners, our legacy builders. If you're curious what a legacy builder is, that's simply a person who's decided to say, not only do I want to pray for Intentional, I want to help Intentional, even in financial terms, to help fuel this ministry and this mission forward. So if you haven't had an opportunity to check that out, you can go to intentionalparents.org. You can click the link in the show notes, but we just want to invite you today. Pray about becoming a legacy builder and partnering with us in a deeper way to help families all around the world. All right, back to this week's episode.
But yeah, Darcy and I met in 1996, May 24th. My birthday is May 25th. I was 22. I was the day before I turned 23. I had just signed, you know, and I had this belief in the 90s. It's funny, music today, kids don't really care. Like I actually find that there's far less really young bands.
Yeah.
Signed.
Yeah.
I think people are just much slower to grow into maturity.
Yep.
It's like weird to think that the Beatles did everything between the age of 20 and 30. Like
I didn't realize. Yeah. I didn't realize.
They were like 17 when they like started, you know.
Wow.
And they broke up when they were all 30 years old, like, which is a lot of artists today don't even get signed till their 30s.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But in the 90s it was still a very young game. In fact, if you were like and you're late. Like I remember meeting a kid that was trying to make it at 28, and I'm like,
"Yeah,
so old." Like, you know, so I started at 20. I'm like, and all the bands that I loved got signed by 20. It seemed like 22 is like the magic
prime
number.
Age. Yeah.
And I'm like, I was 22, and it was like, I'm almost 23, and I got signed 4 months before I turned 23. So
okay.
I felt like I
what record made label? It. I mean, I remember this story because I know you, but. For those listening, what record label was that?
Well, I signed originally to an independent label in Portland called Tim Kerr Records.
Yep.
It doesn't exist anymore, but that's like the label that Everclear, Dandy Warhols, my best friend's band, Super Deluxe, was on. They're another Seattle band. And then there was like all these like classic, like old school post-punk bands, really famous bands like Para Ubu, The Wipers, there was actually a lot of really Poison Idea, which is like the
you're saying all these bands
the most like, quintessential what? Like Portland, they were like the hardcore band, like you're gonna get beat up if you went to their concert. Yeah. Like, but yeah, so it was a cool label. It was like Portland's Sub Pop, like okay. Very similar. But yeah, I was playing a show at I know I just realizing we're talking to a Christian audience, they're like, I don't know what you're talking about and I'm never gonna listen to any of those bands. Playing a show at the Satyricon, which is like a famous now defunct club that was in Chinatown. And it's the club that Kurt Cobain met Courtney Taylor at, you know, it's like kind of everybody played there. And it was this nasty, like stinky punk bar. And we had a showcase there. It was like the 25 year anniversary of the Satyricon.
Okay.
So all these labels took different nights. And
okay.
So we had the Friday night. I was crazy because Elliot Smith played there like the next night, which is like so sad I missed.
Oh.
I never saw him play before he died. My band was staying with my drummer's girlfriend's friend in Portland, who happened to be Darcy's roommate. And so so Darcy was supposed to go camping, and my drummer's girlfriend, Annie, and Darcy's roommate, Mindy, talked Darcy into coming to the show. And she's 5 years older than me. So she is like, at the time she worked in very corporate world. It was like very refined, super elegant.
Yeah.
Darcy looks the same. Like she always looks the same. It's funny. I'm like a chameleon. And she like, I just actually went through photos today. And it's like the woman like does not change. It's like the funniest thing. And she came in, it's like in the, you know, 90s, like grunge era, like post grunge, but it's still like everything's a little gritty.
Yeah.
And Darcy's like in this still perfect like Nordstrom summer dress and like her hair's like all just beautiful and super long and she smelled amazing. And like I just like the first thing I said to her was, "You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life."
Wow.
And I, you know, here she is. She's like 20, she's 28, and I'm like just about to turn 23 and I'm like got raccoon eyeliner on and like a burgundy lipstick and a dog chain around my neck.
I've seen this photo. Yeah. This is a photo. I've seen this photo.
No, I look like a more surly, like Ziggy Stardust, you know? And, but for whatever reason, she ate it up. And, we played the show that night and I was supposed to go out with friends. And instead she's like, "I think you should come back with me." So Darcy took me home that night. It was weird. It was crazier than any Christian parent would ever want their kids to do.
Yes.
We ended up staying up, talked all night. But it was like weird. The next morning we were like a couple. It was like, I was already in love with her. Like, and I think her with me, she wrote a letter to her parents, the day. So that was Friday night. I sent the band home on Saturday and I stayed all weekend in Portland with her. I always joke, this is why Darcy and I don't do premarital counseling, because we have no idea, because we weren't Christians when we met or when we got married.
But, that's right. That's right.
But Darcy wrote a letter to her parents on Sunday saying she met the one.
Whoa. Wow. I didn't know it was that. Yeah, I didn't realize it was close.
We got our names tattooed on each other 2 weeks after meeting.
Wow.
So, and then I came to faith 2 years after we got married, and then her 2 years after me. So I came to faith in 99. We got married in 97. I came to faith in 99 and then her in 2001 after Henry was born.
Wow. Yeah. And how did you come to faith again?
Yeah, I came to faith just, you know, I'd lost my record deal like not long after we got married. I was heartbroken because it was my God, you know, and I always say that gods are, you know, your faith is only as good in the object in which you place your faith. And faith was in my career. And that, you know, they always say like, believe in yourself. Well, that's only good if what you believe comes true, but what if it blows up in your face?
Yeah.
Then what does that actually say about our faith?
Yes.
You know, so
yes.
For me, it was like, I never even allowed, I'm so, you know, I'm an optimist from, I'm an optimist in an unhealthy way that comes from a lot of childhood trauma. Mm. I learned to be extremely positive to deal with extremely painful things. Yeah. But it's kind of a curse and a gift, you know. And the curse is that just, I would never even allow myself to believe that it would be possible that I wouldn't make it in music. Mm. And then for me to even allow that thought to creep in, it was like,
too much.
Like unhinged me. Like, is life even worth living kind of thinking, you know? And then I would, you know, wake up the next day and try to get back to that, you know, unreasonable optimism. So I was hitting that crisis, that panic button, and it wasn't getting better. And I just started, I had gotten into it. My band had lost its record deal because Tim Kerr, we ended up on a major label with Mercury Records. And that was a time, you know, before, you know, streaming. And so, you know, if your single didn't break at radio, you're done, And so, you know, labels just sign up bands, toss your single out if it took off and within 2 weeks, otherwise you're like, you'd be shelved essentially. And so to lose your record deal, you know, I'm 24 now and I'm like already out of a record deal.
You're old now.
Yeah.
You're old
and at 24. So the next couple of years I just kind of spent chasing after things. And I ended up in a band that was doing really well. But two of the members got hooked on heroin and that was I actually had enough of a moral compass to know that, cause we were on the verge of signing a big deal, but I was so unhappy in the band. And I just this has got to be more than this. And so I started reading a Bible my mom gave me And I just became compelled by Jesus and ended up at a small, I decided after kind of coming to terms, like, I think I believe this, but I don't understand it. I ended up finding a little Calvary Chapel in Wallingford, and it was actually had a ton of musicians in it. Like, and a lot of the bands even that I knew in Seattle, like, you know, classic art world where several of the artists were Christians, but just never talked about it.
Sure.
Like Pedro the Lion, like Damian Jurado.
You're naming, if you are listening to this episode, just pause, go back, write those band names down.
So I made some friends there, and that, and then Darcy, you know, she saw that over about a year, there was like a real transformation in my own life. And, and that's, she's like, if, she saw me lay down like a band about a year into my faith, I like quit everything. I just had this conviction that I was still chasing after my dream, but I thought that now that I have Jesus, he's going to really make me famous. and it was like this deep conviction, like I haven't actually surrendered anything. And that was like the real breakthrough. And that was, I think, a breakthrough for Darce as well. Cause she's like, wow, if he's willing to give up that for this Jesus, there might be something here. And so she ended up meeting some young women that like kind of helped her come to that. But all along, I would say, like, you know, I came to faith and kind of an intellectual faith on my own reading a Bible, but it's the context of community that it all, it was like multiple people in both in our lives that like helped us come to it, you know, an understanding of who Jesus really was.
Well, you had said recently, I'm going to quote yourself to yourself. I wanted you to talk about it, but you mentioned sharing your faith is the best medium for sanctification.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really powerful phrase, but unpack that for us a little bit. And Elizabeth, I'm not trying to take over here. So if you want to ask any questions,
no.
I know you're listening.
You're doing great.
you're just listening. I can see.
I'm just listening.
It's the afternoon. I think you're tired a little bit.
You keep going. So Josh doesn't know. He normally leads, like he kind of facilitates and hosts the podcast. And we all just talk, but he helps keep things rolling. But we're learning that when we do interviews together, he's still used to like leading everything. So we did a couple. And at the end, it was like, I didn't say more than two words. We got to figure out how to like,
it's like
do interviews together.
So I'm leaving.
But no, this is, you lead the charge on this one.
I will just add little bits
if things come to mind. I'm just enjoying listening.
But the best medium for sanctification.
I'll make the, you know, what it says, like that witness is what I would refer to as the engine of sanctification, but probably a better way of saying it is actually love is the engine of sanctification. And love is the thing that makes you, we talk about what we love. And so, you know, for me, the thing that I've begun to realize is like, it's easy when you've walked with the Lord, when you first meet Jesus, you know, I think a lot of, what I'm realizing is that through my years in ministry, a lot of people, yourselves included, you've been Christians your whole lives. So there is a strange advantage that I have.
Yes.
To knowing,
agreed.
Like, I actually know what it's like to be dead in my sin. Now, technically, there was a point when you guys were too.
Sure.
But it's like, it's impossible to identify what that was, you know? Yeah. And what does it mean to come alive in that? And so for me to have such a radical awakening to the Lord, once I had that surrender moment, that's when, you know, I wanted to talk about it with everyone. Cause it's like this has changed my life. Why would I not talk about this?
You know? Of course.
I am by temperament, you know, it's like, I'm a guy who likes to spend a lot of time alone. I love to think about things intensely. But then I want to process it with people. But this was different. This was like relational. Like I wanted people to experience. I knew the ways that my friends were hurting, and I knew the things that were, I'm living life with musicians and people are struggling with drug addiction, and, you know, like, putting all their hopes in things that like could break their heart at any moment. Mm. And I just wanted them to experience the same freedom that I was finding.
Yeah.
And so that, but what I found is that I shared on Sunday, like the first guy I ever led to the Lord was this producer. And I'm like, I'm just been a believer for a couple months. And I'm like, I've been praying the sinner's prayer, if you will, like yeah. every day, because I wasn't convinced that I was actually saved.
It didn't stick.
That's why I say it. Like it took a year for it to kind of really move from intellectual into my heart. Mm. But this, you know, a few months into this new found faith I had, this was a massive marker for me, because this guy, I like started sharing with him about my conversion. And at that same week, his fiance left him.
Yes.
And so he was crushed, and I just, you know, and he saw something in me that I wasn't even seeing in myself. Like he was seeing a change, a light, if you will, that, you know, it's very difficult for us to see the sanctification in our own lives. It's another reason why we need community.
Yeah.
I think that like, I don't think God's hardwired us to be able to like navel gaze in a way that we could determine how far we've grown. I think we need to live with others. Be like, I see the change in you. I see, I see where you've come from.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's not till we look back over our lives. Mm-hmm. Do we really see that, you know?
Yeah.
But in that time, it's like, I'm praying this prayer every day, but I'm like telling him about what I do know. And it's pretty minimal. Like, you know, I don't have some sort of like strong theological grid.
Yeah.
I'm like, I just thought Jesus was really compelling. And I believe that he was the answer to the mystery of life's frustrations, you know? And so I could say that I thought he died for the world, and I could say that I thought he rose from the dead. And I could say that I thought he was Lord, but I couldn't, it's like, I'm not going to explain what atonement meant or something.
Yes.
And he, by the end of the week, he's like, I think I believe you. Like, what do I need to do?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, funny thing is, so I pray this prayer, you know, and I remember it from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, you ask Jesus into your heart to forgive you of your sins and confess that you believe he's God and like that he rose from the dead, blah, blah. And he's like, all right, I'll do it. And I'm like, well, good. Cause I'm like, I want to just be clear. I'm not even totally sure I'm saved.
Hey, we want to remind you about the Intentional Motherhood Retreat, October 3rd through 5th. Starts on a Thursday night, ends on a Saturday morning here in Bend, Oregon, where we live. Space is filling up quickly, but we do still have some spots left. We'd love for you to come join us. Mom, what else do they need to know?
Well, this retreat really lends itself towards bringing your friends and your family, your sister, your mom, whoever with you. It is an awful lot of fun. And remember that what we're teaching is not about how to be the perfect mom, but how to really respond to God so that he can do the spiritual formation in our lives that all of us are longing for.
Yeah, so to find out more or to register, click the link in our bio, and we can't wait to see you in October.
I was going to pray it again anyway. So you want to pray this with me? And he's like, yeah, so we prayed it. But here's the thing. I saw something change in him in that moment.
Yeah.
And the reason I say it's the engine of sanctification. And so I say it's I discovered that I was loved, even though I doubted it. My flesh would get in the way of that.
Mm.
But it is ultimately what I discovered is that I was loved. And then I was falling in love with Jesus, but I still was uncertain. It's kind of like it's like a romance that you like enter into and you're like, I think I love this person, but I'm still scared it could end at any moment. That's more how my doubts played out. It wasn't that I was doubting that it was true. I was just like, I was concerned that it could end. I didn't yet understand its permanence. But this moment with him, ended that question forever.
Interesting.
Because I saw an instantaneous change in him. All of a sudden I was like, whoa.
There's something.
Yeah, this is, I'm like, I am saved.
Yeah.
And God just used me.
Wow.
To introduce someone else to himself.
Hmm.
And I was like, I got to understand this better.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately I wanted to read my Bible more. I wanted to pray more. I started reading. I remember immediately after I just started like I went from not really being much of a reader during my early 20s to all of a sudden like getting up every day at 5 and like I read all of C.S. Lewis's works over like the next few months. Like I read like Tozer's, like I read
a little obsessive of, parts of your personality.
But it was like I just wanted to understand this thing that it's like when you fall in love with someone, it's like you want to know who they are. Like I wasn't into gardening. I was into Darcy, and Darcy's into gardening. Well, then that's another way that I can get to know her on a deeper level by making her interest my interest. So that's what I mean when I say that that witness is the engine of sanctification. And the reason I say that is because with all of the interest right now in spiritual formation, when we talk about doing the things that Jesus did, I think the challenge of that statement is that we need to know why he did it. And he did all the things that he did because his mission was to seek and save that which was lost. As a man, you know, we always forget that Jesus was always the eternal Son, but the incarnation is something new. He wasn't always man.
Says
God has always been the Father, but he wasn't always creator until he created something. this mystery of Jesus, his intimacy with the Father, the things that even all the things that he was calling his disciples to participate in, was for the purpose of being what they were told when he rose from the dead, and you will be witnesses to the ends of the world. All of it was meant to serve that purpose. So I think a lot of times we start talking about prayer, we start talking about fasting, we talk about scripture reading, we talk about sexual ethics, all these things, and they're disconnected from the why. It's like, and the why can't just simply be because it's good for you.
Absolutely.
The why actually needs to be like, no, because you're like, you are, Paul uses language like you exercised to compete, you were like, so I would say it's like, I'm like, we've kind of turned our Christian lives and even the disciplines, we've lost the why. And so what we end up is burned out with the practices. Because if the practices aren't leading to becoming the sign that God has called us to be, and I believe it's best together. I even think the spiritual practices, even practices like solitude and silence, ultimately are meant to serve the community. I think John Mark stated that really well in his new book, that these, that this is always meant to ultimately, I go, always go back to Thomas Merton's, classic, drawn a blank on it. Such a powerful book too. Seeds of Contemplation. He said, solitude must always serve the community, or it's not really solitude. Then it's just isolation. But I think that all of it should serve this bigger goal. It's like, think of it as like, you're an Olympic athlete and your sport is, you know, you're going to run, you're like a long distance runner. Training endlessly is pretty meaningless if you actually never compete. I think that our, and if we think that the goal is just simply like we do these practices that we might know Jesus better, well, I would argue, I think there's a fundamental flaw to say that you actually think you know Jesus better if you're actually not, if you're not entering into Jesus's mission.
Which is to seek and to save that which was lost.
And so I'm I'm like, if you're not telling people about Jesus, if you're not, and listen, I don't mean like personal evangelism, being able to articulate the gospel. Some people, that will never be their gift. I'm talking about being a witness to Jesus in the way that he made you. And you play your part in the community as a whole. That's why I say at the opening line for this little book I'm writing, it just came to me this week, is the church is the best evangelist. Not I'm the best evangelist. I've been to churches where the lead pastor is a great evangelist. I don't know if I've ever been to a church where the church sees that it together is the evangelist. Now it says God gives the church evangelists and preachers, but I'm saying like all Christians are to be, to have an evangelistic impulse, which is we want to not, this isn't about proselytizing. This is about introducing people to the King in the unique way he made you. So maybe he made you as a hospitality person. He made you as a service person, a missions or a justice person. But all those things should be your ability to say, to give people the reason for the hope that is within you. And that might just be as simple as like, why do you love me so well? Man, it's because I love Jesus. You should come to my church with me. Now you're playing a part as a community and you're letting people that have these other gifts do the heavy lifting in their area of gifting.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it takes the whole.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering too, were you going to ask something?
I have a question, but
go. First. No. You go. I'm ladies first.
I'm thinking of all the people who would maybe say, that is how I want to live my life. Maybe they would even say that that is how I'm loving my neighbor. I know all of my neighbors. That is how I'm showing Jesus to people. But I don't think I need the church.
Yeah.
I feel like that's maybe it's not the majority, but I feel like we run into that a lot.
It's
of like, I'm doing all these things. I don't understand why I need this flawed church community. And we've talked a lot before, and I think even on the podcast of like, we also need to understand the why behind why go to church, why be in a church community. And so often we approach it, it's all about us. What am I getting from it?
Yep.
I don't like the preaching. My kid doesn't like the class. I don't like, we've gotten it so wrong of what it exists for. So what would you say to those people who are like, okay, I can,
that was exactly where I was going to go.
Well, perfect. Yes. We must be married.
So I would simply say, and I don't mean to be mean, but they're lying to themselves.
Mm.
And I would simply say this, you can't say you love Jesus and hate the thing that he laid his life down for.
Hmm.
How could you say you love Jesus and hate his bride? Mm. I think it's two things. It's two missteps. Not only is it like an absolute impossibility. So whatever Jesus you think you serve, if you reject his church, I would argue that you don't know the Jesus you think you know. Or you've created a Jesus in your own likeness. But Jesus says that the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, the true church. There's two things that you, that are deeply dangerous with this mindset. First of all, you're telling Jesus, I love you, but I hate your wife. Which I would also say you are his wife.
Yeah.
So your two things you're missing is that you're scapegoating.
Mm.
Because you aren't seeing that you are just as much of a part of the problem that you say is the problem.
Mm.
And somehow you think the problem doesn't exist if you're not with others, when the fact is that wherever you are, sin is right there with you. So it is an underestimating the sin in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an undervaluing of the thing that Jesus died for.
Mm. Okay, I have a further question.
That's so good.
I'm tracking with you. And I think there's people who need to hear that.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. That's what you are.
Okay, classic but now, song. Now talk to me about maybe the people who, they don't have a big problem with church, but they do have a big problem making it a priority.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a central part of their life. It's a like, when I get to it, I like that church every once in a while, or like half in, half out.
Mm-hmm.
But they would say they deeply love Jesus. And what I'm getting at is I feel like this is where we find a lot of families,
mm-hmm.
is other things mm-hmm. get in the way. Other things are more important. They wouldn't maybe say they've really thought it through and have a reason why they don't go to church.
Yeah.
But there may be like they're just occasionally – it's not like I said, it's not a central part of their weekly rhythms, of their family culture, of their – it's not a high value.
Yeah. Well, I would simply say once again, there's a shallowness to their relationship with Jesus. And I'm not trying to be offensive by this because I know how difficult it is to, I always joke that I started a church because I probably wouldn't have gone to church any longer.
Yeah.
If I wasn't leading it.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying all families, you know, that's the famous line from Mary Carr in her memoir, Lit. She says a dysfunctional family is any family with more than one person in it, which I just find so helpful. It's like, listen, church is challenging. Like I've been leading Dorfell for 15 years. Like, and it's, you know, if I'm not preaching, if, you know, it's hard to make myself go and I'm the lead pastor, you know, it's like, I get it, but it's just like parenting is hard, but it's also the hardest things in life are also the most beautiful and wonderful. So I think that when people live like that, what they're doing is they're actually undermining the very relationship that they want to lift up. Like, oh, I just talked to the young girl. We lost so many young people during COVID. They stopped going to church, and they found. I always say that, you know, the reason I got off the road, off touring after I started Telecast was not because it was super hard to be away from Darcy and Henry. In fact, it was the opposite of that. It was super hard at first. Mm-hmm. But the longer I did it, the easier it became because it was the new norm. And before long, I'm a year in, I've done 265 shows and I've missed my son's second and third birthday. Did I love my wife and son? I did, but I was not loving them well. And there was a shallowness to my relationship with them that was increasing the more time I spent away. And the more time I spent away, the more I rationalized it because I was, and it was pushing me once again toward the same selfishness that I had as a secular artist. And that's the reason I quit my band. Right. I saw the danger in it. And when Darcy called me one day and she's like, I don't have the grace for you to do this anymore. And we made a pact. The moment she said that, I would quit. And this is at the top of our game. We had a top five single that had been on the top 10 for 6 months. We were set up to be big on the next record, and I blew it all up because it wasn't worth losing my family for. So this is where I think people fool them. They think this. I think most people that say stuff like that, it's not going to church is still a relatively new thing because this is how it goes usually. First, it's like, yeah, I love Jesus still, and I just like, you know, I've just been busy and church is hard. And then it's like after a while, it's like actually I don't see the need for church. Mm-hmm. You cannot continue on that track without it ultimately. What I find is that people that do this long term ultimately stop believing in Jesus. Or he becomes such a
different, twisted
such a back, like back of the brain thought. Like,
yes.
And that's just like any relationship. Yeah. Like you can say you love your wife, but if you don't ever make time for her, spend time with her, like, you know, or you can say you love your family, but if you're absent, you know, your words are kind of meaningless. And so that's where I think that the community, and two, I think it's missing the second thing. And so if the church, if we actually got back to the idea that the church is a sign and that it's the us together, that lift up Jesus most effectively. When two or more gathered my name, there's a unique manifestation of God's presence when God's people meet together. And so if the church actually got back to this idea that we exist for the good of those outside the walls, I actually think it would make church very exciting again. I think part of the problem is that we got bored with the gospel. We thought we were bored with it. So we start chasing all these other things, like whether it's like silly things like, you know, the prayer of Jabez or Enneagram. And then like none of that matters. Oh, and I don't even care. Like I'm not making a statement. I am making a statement about prayer of Jabez, like whatever, personality tests, all those things. But there is no difference between that and a just self-help book. And what's the purpose of understanding myself if I don't understand why I'm left here after Jesus saves me? The only reason he leaves me here and left you here is because he wants to reach other people through you. And what an unbelievable responsibility and privilege. So that's where I think people have lost their, I actually blame church leadership. I blame myself for not making, for drifting from that central purpose because it requires an intentionality that it, and so when we don't have that intentionality, human beings are masters of filling in that space with something that makes us feel good about the nagging voice of conscience. So I'm like, I'm not doing that. So I'm going to really do this so I don't feel bad about that.
We have a new offering for you. If you would like to receive daily or weekly text messages and encouragement around parenting, marriage, with prayers and scriptures, click the link in the show notes and we would love to send those to you. Can't wait to connect more with you.
You know, obviously we're talking about what we're seeing now. You're saying it's a relatively new thing, and I would agree with you that people are like, it's just not a part of people's rhythms.
I think it's been in the works for a long time.
I think that's what I'm thinking about.
Pushed it over the...
And I'm thinking of even the, you know, era of the church that we grew up in where there was, and there's absolute reasons for it. If you trace the history, which I think is so important to understand the history of where we were to understand how we got to where we are now.
Yeah.
But when we were growing up, there was a heavy emphasis in the church on morality. I mean, just take like purity culture as an example.
Yeah.
There was so much about the don't, but nobody explained the why.
Yeah.
Not really. Just maybe a phrase or two.
Yeah.
And then
it was about sinning less.
Exactly. Exactly.
And but that, it should be about loving more.
Worked in, yes. That worked until it really didn't.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing it with our peers all over who have deconstructed their faith and no longer believe in God. But so much of it stems from, well, my parents just told me, don't do this and don't do this and don't do this. Nobody ever explained to me why. Nobody ever saw me as a person. Mm-hmm. Now we're swinging the pendulum way too far with all about only ever just seeing your kids, never acknowledging any of the things that they do.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're swinging it way too far. How can anything be lasting and meaningful if it first doesn't actually mean something to us?
Yeah.
We are selfish creatures. That's just, it has to mean something to us. And there, and what you're talking about is, man, if we had a shared purpose around why we exist, why we do this thing called church that's hard and messy and imperfect and we're going to hurt each other, but we have a shared mission, that changes the whole thing.
Yeah. And I would argue that actually what's so beautiful about the communal piece, yes, it's complicated and you don't get to pick your, just like you don't get to pick your family, you don't get to pick the people you go to church with either.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be best friends with everybody, but, but the thing is Jesus himself said, they will know you're my disciples by your love for one another. And this is one of the things I would say, like this idea of, and people say, well, I love my neighbors and, but it's like people that disconnect themselves from church and say they still, you know, are maintaining their faith. Like, let's like, and if that's you as a listener, I just would ask, like, be honest, like how often, like you may be loving your neighbor well, you may be in relationship with non-believers. You could have your wine club, your book club, all these things. But I mean, how often are you really asking a person like eternal questions? Mm-hmm. Like, do you know this Jesus that I know? Like, because we think that we're witnessing to Jesus by being nice to people. Like, that's, you know, yes, we are to treat people with dignity. I would say that effective witness means that you don't treat people as projects. So, and we respect people where they're at, and it's not your responsibility to even make them believe. But what are you inviting them to if you yourself are disconnected from the church? And what do you say? What does your spirituality say to these people if it's not connected to anyone else?
Yes.
And so I always think like you have to take into consideration Jesus's own statement when he was asked, what's the most important commandment? He doesn't just give one. He gives two. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. I would say that they're two sides of the same coin, that loving God, we were created to be in intimacy with God. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the living God. But the second commandment is actually the evidence of the first.
Yeah.
So you can't really love God and not love neighbor. And loving neighbor is that your neighbor includes your enemy. And once you start realizing that, then you start realizing, man, I need other people to help me do that.
And
so that's where I think that where I recognize that the church, that because it's led by sinful men and women, that brokenness can have a deep impact on us. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not diminishing people, but I think, man, we've got to get over our victimization mentality. And it's like, there's problems with everything. It's not hard to, you don't have to look far in anything to find a problem. That's why I love Eugene Peterson's statement. If we would remember that people are sinners, we wouldn't be surprised when they sin.
Yeah.
And that's why I said that.
That's
why I think the cross is so central, because the cross, you can't stand before the crucified king and not be confronted with your own brokenness. And I would argue we don't even truly know what sin is until we're saved. Because the closer you get to Jesus, so I would say one of the evidences that you're growing in your life with Jesus is you actually see your own mess more and more clearly, which makes you far more gentle in how you deal with others.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. You know, you talk about at times the culture of privatization And how that plays into this, because now we're at a time where everything's so private, right? Mm-hmm. And everything's like, well, it's our little family. And COVID, obviously, we don't need to go into it. But that idea, like now you're just doing, you're doing church privately at home, mm-hmm. Obviously accelerated the problem. But, you know, in a culture where everybody wants to basically, as quickly as they can, get home and be by themselves, which mm-hmm. is the predominant, like people are excited about going out because they get to go back in. Jerry Seinfeld has this beautiful, hilarious whole thing. He's like, why do we go out? We go out because then we get to go back in. He's like, that's yeah, the best totally. Part about going out.
Every
and it's like going in is the best part, but you have to go out to go in. You know, it's funny deal. But, you know, how do we think about this practically? Because this, I think, evangelism slash just telling people about the power and the goodness and the good news and the freedom that comes in Jesus truly has gotten drowned out in our moment, even in the Christian moment that we're in the Christian cultures and circles I know we're in, it's a lower priority.
Yeah. And now Alpha in the UK, like saves. I mean, I went to it. It's like insane, like 900 people showing up for dinner. Mm. Alpha in the US is like serves pastors who are reluctant to preach the gospel and gets it off their plate so they don't have to worry about it and feel bad about it anymore, which is why it's one of the reasons I think it hasn't done that well in the US.
Yeah.
It's not been nearly as effective as it's been in other places in the world. And we do it. I think it's wonderful. But I think once again, it's like, it should be a avenue, not the avenue.
Yes.
It's like, and it should, and that's the thing is the reason it's so effective at HB, because that is they know why they're there. Because Nikki's the, you know, it's like he's the founder of it. Like it's like his heartbeat. And so it bleeds into everything they do as a church, you know?
But you talked about knowing that why.
Yeah.
So for somebody listening, who's like, Josh, why? Like, you kind of have already said it, but I'd love for you to just in sum, why does it matter so much for us to actually preach the gospel? Why does it matter to go to church and be in community?
Well, first of all, let's take the concept of like why church?
Yep.
Why church as, you know, the church has been the church, which is supposed to be the witness to the reality. We're kingdom outposts.
Yeah.
Of a kingdom that's coming in whole and full. So, and you can't talk about a kingdom without talking about a king.
Mm-hmm.
But the church's mission has been tossed to parachurch ministries.
Mm.
And you know, I heard this story once. Alan Redpath, one of the great 50s revivalist English preachers, that was really influential older man. You know, he's already at the end of his life when the Jesus movement happened, but he was a big voice in that circle. But there was a time when he was the pastor. He left the UK to become the pastor of Moody Church in Chicago. And he was, it was like in the, I think it was like in the 50s or 60s, Billy Graham was doing a crusade in Chicago. And Alan Redpath asked Billy Graham about like parachurch ministries, evangelism, and its relationship to the church. And Billy Graham turned to him privately and said, if the church did its job, my job would not be necessary. So this has been a thing that's been in process for a long time. And I do think that it's because American evangelicalism has what I refer to as a Puritan hangover. It has been way more caught up in presenting an ideal that itself can't keep, which is why we have pastors bombing out all the time, and which is so heartbreaking.
Yes.
So when I think about witness, I think that first of all, why put so much emphasis on witness in terms of the community? And I say this, like we preach, that word preach is a confessional statement. So the we tells me that every person in the body of Christ has a part to play in the whole.
Yes.
So we need to do it together and we need to learn how to do it together. And one of the ways we do that together is we love each other and we love Jesus well publicly.
Yes.
So that's one of the things why church matters is it's a public expression.
Yeah.
So the church isn't there for you to go and learn how to privately grow. And that's why that's not a sustainable model. What we actually need to get back to is that the main reason we gather on Sunday is it's a proclamation when I preach at River Bend on Sunday, we come together to make a proclamation that Jesus is King in the city of Bend. Mm. And it's open. The doors are open to anyone that comes in. And every week there was a guy, I met a woman on Sunday who said she knew I was preaching, and she's like, I think my dad would relate to you. He's not a believer. And he came up to me right after the sermon. He said, I really appreciated your talk.
Sure, sure.
So it's like, we are witness. You don't know, you know, who's there. When we talk about preaching, well, how, if I'm not a preacher, what does that mean for me? I think let's change that word and just say the we is, it's a communal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be at church to be a part of that community. Yeah. You got to participate in the things that that community does.
Mm-hmm.
But the preach, think of the word confessional.
Yes.
And it's not just confessing that Jesus is Lord, but it's also confession of our own brokenness to one another. Sure. Because what we're declaring when we do that is now we are relatable. Now we're a place, we're like, wait a minute, these people are talking about things that I struggle with, but they have joy.
Mm.
And they're not afraid to say it.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's what I said on Sunday is like I'm not afraid to confess my sins because I know that my sin has already been forgiven. But I also know that unconfessed sin, even if it's forgiven, still wreaks havoc in my life.
If you're enjoying this content and you want to go deeper, we have an amazing resource that we want to tell you about. It's the Intentional Film Series, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. Now, this is an incredible tool for you for spiritual formation in the family. And we created this film series to help parents in their God-given task to raise and disciple their own children. Now, our hope is that we're able to help you and give you some of the tools that I know we so desperately need as we're in the process of raising our kids, and Phil and Diane have actually raised their kids. This is a 9-session film series on the process of what raising a passionate Jesus follower actually looks like. There's some workable solutions in here. There's a bunch of wisdom from the scriptures, and there's a bunch of practical help in your journey as you are raising your children. We cover all sorts of things like parental roles, goals versus values. What is discipline versus punishment? How do I create a heart of obedience in my child where they actually want to obey? What does a heart of self-control look like? Or how do I even help my child in the process of character development? We cover that and so many more things. You can use this film series in a variety of ways. You can use it at your home, preferably with your spouse if that's applicable, with a group of friends or in your community, or even through your local church. All you need to do is head over to our website, intentionalparents.org, click on film series, and then follow the prompts. We have a bunch of other resources there that you can check out, but we do pray that this blesses you in your pursuit of raising passionate Jesus followers.
Well, just even on the confessional part, to be real and transparent, you shared a wonderful story of on your way to church. Can you mind sharing that?
Yeah, like I tried to kill a cyclist. We flipped each other off.
On the way to church.
Yeah, I'm sure I yelled the F word at him. and him at me. And then I got to church and I got into the my office to calm down, to get ready to preach the gospel of grace to the world. And then I was like already feeling bad, and I walked out and I saw the bike in the bike rack. Or at least what I thought was the bike rack. I should never talk to the person. So I still to this day don't know for sure that it was that person, but I think it was. And the thing is, it doesn't matter. What mattered is that I was confronted with a quandary. And it was like, do I hide this very human kind of ugly response?
Sure.
And pretend like, you know, I've been nothing but, you know, sitting at the foot of heaven all morning in preparation of, you know, bringing King Jesus to all of you.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I don't feel good about what I did. And I need to model for the church not only what it looks like to confess Jesus as King, but I need to model what it looks like to live under Jesus as King.
Yeah.
And King Jesus says, you're going to blow it, but you need to confess it when you do.
Yeah.
Confess your sins to one another. Yeah. I love that. It's like even when James, people are sick. I believe people are physically sick in church because they have unconfessed sin.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's always why you're sick.
Yeah.
I would actually say sin is always why we're why we're sick, but it's not necessarily personal sin. It's just the sin that's impacted the entire creation. Sure. All creation groans. Sure. I just did a message on sin and I got asked that question. Like, are you saying that my depression is because of sin? I'm like, back that up, not necessarily your personal sin. Maybe sure. it is, but
yeah.
it's because
yeah.
all of creation has been impacted. Death yes. has entered the story yes. and it infiltrates every arena of existence. But right. I believe that what Jesus wants us to do is to, we are to actually, part of the way we declare his victory over death and sin is by our unwillingness to pretend it's not a problem, because we actually believe Christ is victor over that problem. So it's like, it's a now and not yet reality. And yes. so until that reality is fully now, we are called to confess even things that are already forgiven. And so, and it's like, and I think that we often, you know, I heard of a pastor once that had an affair, and he was confronted by his elder board. And when they said, you need to confess this to your church. And he says, I answer to God and God alone. Wrong answer. And because it never was confessed, that pastor, who was the head of a movement, he, like, kept putting guys that had affairs back into the pulpit because he himself had never come clean. And I think that this is the way that sin wreaks havoc. Forgiven sin wreaks havoc in the church. It doesn't at all diminish the fact that the guy was used powerfully. It doesn't diminish that he's a Christian. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
It creates problems. And it's what creates that layer that where the church is full of hypocrisy. I'm like, well, humans are hypocrites. What I would say is the church doesn't need to be. And if it just was more honest about its brokenness, I actually think our witness would just go through the roof. And it's why Alpha works, because Alpha creates a space where people can be honest about their doubts and their questions. And they're not judged for it. We shouldn't need Alpha to do that. That should just be how the church functions.
And for anyone that's curious about Alpha, Alpha is a rad organization
it
out
is.
Of London
yeah.
that basically has a bunch of content to leading people to Jesus, led by Nikki Gumbel.
Great. I think it technically is the most effective.
I've ran a couple of this. They're amazing.
They're incredible.
But you stood up at church and you actually told the church this. Am I
that
correct?
That I did this thing. And I had at least 10 people come to me. People laughed. And, you know, I like using self-deprecating humor to dismantle people's walls that they put up against faith. And that I do think that's why comedians get away with saying
crazy,
insane
stuff.
Things.
Yeah.
They say things often. The best comedians speak prophetically to the issues of the day, and they use comedy. And I've always, one of my favorite authors of all time is G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what I loved about him is that he was a man that was just marked by joy. You know, he referred to himself as the court jester. I wish Christians, I wish we were better at taking not taking ourselves or the world so seriously,
yes, sir.
But taking Jesus, grace, and others very seriously. So I like to play the court jester because I think it
helps.
Someone said, I love it, Josh. You make me laugh while you're stabbing me in the stomach. And that's always been kind of the goal. As long as I'm not stabbing you in the back.
So it's communal, it's confessional. I even wrote this down. And you have two more.
So at the cross, with Jesus, it's personal.
Yeah.
I would say that the gospel, we're not introducing people to an ideology. And I think, Elizabeth, you said this well. It's like, I was raised in an era which church became about, it wasn't about Jesus. That's not about Jesus if it's about what you do and don't do.
Yeah.
You're right. Martin Luther is one of my favorites, early Luther especially. And once again, I've never found anyone in church history that wasn't flawed somewhere. This is another reason why we need community.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous to trust a single voice. even how do we discern the Spirit's voice? Honestly, that often is done in the context of community.
Yes.
Because you can confuse your own brain and magical thinking for the voice of Jesus. Luther had a partner in crime in reforming the world, and that was Melanchthon, who's also a brilliant thinker. But Melanchthon he had come to the same conclusions of this, that we are saved by grace. And that grace is just like an absolute enigma because it's always unfair, essentially.
Yes.
But Melanchthon was having doubts about this. And so he writes a letter to Luther. He's like, I'm just struggling to believe that God isn't mad at me, you know, that. And Luther writes him this crazy letter. And he says, like, listen, if you were to kill someone every day, if you were to commit adultery, you were to do all these things, not one of those things would move the needle even a degree in regards to the finished work of Jesus on the cross. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't even move the needle in regards to his feelings toward you, because his salvation isn't based upon you. It's based upon him. And this is that concept of grace is the one-way love of God. But he said, so listen, Melanchthon, sin boldly.
Yes, I remember this. Yes.
And he said, but then he goes on. So that line is taken deeply out of context.
Yes, totally.
Because he's not saying go sin. What he's saying is that sin is a part of your experience that you will not escape on this side of eternity. Mm. So learn to deal with it. And the only way to deal with it, and if you want to actually sin less, he says, sin boldly, but love the mercy of Jesus. Cling to that mercy even more boldly. Mm. So he's like, so what he's saying essentially is that the goal is not sinning less, it's loving more. Mm. That when I actually love more, when I just enter into that mission, when I enter into the why, if I spend more time worrying about other people meeting Jesus, I would sin a lot less. So that's, it's like a smoker trying to stop smoking by not thinking about smoking. Like, well, the only way to actually get stopped, usually what they say for bad habits, is to replace it with a new habit, with something that's better. And so I always say, like, you know, it's not about arriving. It's about knowing.
Yeah.
And it's not about sinning less. It's about loving more. And so that tells us something really profound. It's also one of our problems in the church is relationship is far more nebulous than it is prescriptive.
Yeah,
but church is often far more prescriptive than it is relational.
Weird. Yes.
And I think that's another reason why people left, because they weren't getting the relationships that they
needed.
And so that's on the church. And that's where we have to come back to this place of kind of this, what I refer to as sort of a radical grace, kind of messy. Like, I want church to function like an AA meeting, you know? It's like, I love it when we have a Chuck Bomar, dear friend, we all know.
Great.
I had him speak at Door of Hope in October, and he gave this amazing message just about every person, just be who God made you to be. And it was like, and I followed up his message with just a call to, like, he said, nothing robs you of being who God made you to be when you're obsessed with being what you see others being. And I just called, I'm like, I just feel like that's a problem for a lot of you in here. I know it's a problem for me at times. You know, I know what it's like to live. I mean, I'm the pastor who worked for John Mark Comer, who had Josh Garrels as his worship, as a worship leader and elder, and had Tim Mackey as the other teaching pastor. You know, I'd like to sit in every meeting with someone from your own church and be told probably once a week that they prefer Tim's teaching. Like, when I go, every time I go to the UK, that, you know, like, oh, you're from Portland. Do you know John Mark? I'm like, I do. And I'm like, I'm 51. I'm actually grateful that these guys have actually shielded me from a lot of, I'm still pastoring in Portland because of the sacrifices they have made in the front.
Sure.
I mean, I know it's like to get an email saying that my record changed someone's life and be offered a $12,000 gig in Texas, only to read the end of the letter and see it said, farther along really has changed my life, and realize that the letter actually was not to me at all. It was to Josh Garrels, not Josh White. all of these things are refer to as, you know, humility learned in the school of humiliation.
Oh my gosh.
You said though, you said that the gospel is personal, but it's never private.
Yeah.
And that, you know, on that line of personal, like, it's absolutely personal, but it's not private.
Yeah.
And I think I'm quoting you to you, but I think that's a very important piece of all this, that it's not meant for you. alone. It's not meant to be a private thing.
You can't say you love God and not love your neighbor. In fact, that's why I said Martin Buber once said, every time I cannot look away from my neighbor's face without looking away from the face of God. I share that even living in the shadows of guys who have had more success in different arenas of things I'm interested in do.
Sure.
It's like, that's the thing is like, that's what we tend to make life about is achievement. And it's like, and then it's all of a sudden we start turning toward these like lists of things to do to climb that ladder. Mm. And it's like, but that's why it's not only is it personal, it's about Jesus. It's about, it's about knowing him and making him known.
Yes.
I always use that line. It's like Will Ferrell and Elf when he like busts into the office.
Oh, yeah.
I'm in love and I don't care who knows. I'm like that. That's I've great. Always just loved that because it's such a powerful embodiment of what a Christian should be like.
Sure.
But it ends with the cross and that's where it has to be sacrificial.
Yeah.
And it's not just about proclaiming the sacrifice of God himself for humanity, but we actually witness to that sacrifice by allowing ourselves to be sacrificed. Mm-hmm. We are not allowed to be spiritual dominators. Mm-hmm. In the words of Jacques Ellul, the church's responsibility is to not play the role of a wolf, is to play the role of the sheep. And the sheep is usually there for sacrifice. Oh, wow. So, and that's where it's like, when people ask me, what will it cost me to follow Jesus?
Like
everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's stinking costly.
Yeah.
And follow in life is impossible.
Yes.
And Jesus is wonderful.
Wow. You've given us so much to think about. I don't even want to dare ask another question because I feel like it'd probably take us down another rabbit hole, but a beautiful rabbit hole, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been very helpful. I think that there is a lot of wisdom and saginess in you. What I've loved is knowing you for so many years. There's been so many loves that you've had, but they've all been really under the umbrella of one love, which is your heart for Jesus and your you have a voice that is not to make people feel good necessarily, but it actually leads to good. Mm-hmm. So maybe you're speaking the truth in love in a way that I think is super important for our churches, for anyone listening. And, you know, anybody that is actually listening to this today are like, whoa, my mind has been like, you know, bent a little bit, helped, encouraged, go check out your stuff. If you're in Portland, go visit Dora Hope. It's a wonderful church.
I would just say this, because I know that I said some hard things for maybe listeners that aren't going to church. And I just want you to know that no matter what I said or no matter whether you're believing lies or not believing lies, none of it changes the fact that Jesus is crazy about you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And nothing will compel you to re-engage with the community and to enter into what I just want for listeners. Is the same thing I want for myself, the same thing I want for my kids and for my community, for my family, for my neighbors. I just want people to know how beautiful God is, how much he loves them. It's like, that's the thing that makes me weep. That's the thing that gives purpose to my life. And it's actually what allows all my weird millions of obsessions. God's like, love me, love neighbor, and then just do what you want. Those things I try to make everything in life serve that central tenet.
Yeah.
You're loved.
Yes.
And that is such a profound thing when you really know that you're loved. It will change everything and how you live.
Agreed. Could not agree more. Josh, thank you for your time. Can't wait for you to drop another record. Also, can't wait for you to write another book. So we'll update people. We'll probably have you on again when all that comes out. But thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.